What's up, everybody? I'm your host, Chris Hampton. Welcome to episode 124 of the Power Company Podcast, brought to you by PowerCompanyClimbing.com. I am currently sitting here in Mount Victoria, Australia, in the middle of the beautiful Blue Mountains. I know that the Grampians and Arapiles get the majority of the attention from international climbers. They certainly did mine, and that's probably warranted. I haven't been there yet, though I am headed there soon. However, the Blue Mountains are a really amazing destination. Very easy to access. The climbing is incredible. A row of little towns that run through the mountains that are gorgeous. And I'm in one of those towns right now in my friend's Airbnb, which she gives a discount to climbers for if you send her a message first. So if you're looking to book a trip to the Blue Mountains, you can find a link to her Airbnb right there in the show notes in your pocket supercomputer. Bookmark that thing, save it, however it works on Airbnb, I'm not sure, but save it so that you can come out here, get a discount, and be right in the thick of things. If you happen to be in Sydney, Melbourne, or Perth, we've still got workshops open. A few are totally booked up, but we do have some openings. I'll be in Sydney in just the next couple of days for two more workshops. Then I move on to Melbourne and then to Perth. So look on the website, powercompanyclimbing.com/OzTour. Book your spot, get your t-shirt. We're coming your way. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time here telling you what's been going on. I'm going to have some episodes soon talking about that. So I'd love to just jump into this conversation today. I sat down with today's guest, Susan Ashley Hunt, back in the summer around the International Climbers Festival in Lander. And we discussed meditation and yoga and how it can impact your climbing. And I was largely interested in talking to Sue. We may bounce back and forth in this interview, calling her Sue or Ashley. I know her as both. And I wanted to talk to her because she's very steeped in the traditional ideas of meditation and yoga. And if something has that massive of a history, there's a reason for it. So I wanted to know how that traditional style meditation and yoga can impact climbing. And like I said, she's very steeped in this. She's got a degree in Hinduism and Buddhism, as well as continued studies in consciousness and transpersonal psychology, as well as extensive yoga studies in India. And that's an area I know very little about, but as my life gets busier and I get older and have less time, I feel like it's something that maybe could improve my quality of life. So let's get into this.
There's so much of my self-image, emotions, and chemicals involved in the process of climbing even before it starts. Meditation on a really simple level has helped to communicate more effectively what we're feeling, what our goals are.
Are you doing yoga workshops as well?
I taught two meditation for climbers workshops.
Okay, and you're doing meditation again tomorrow night.
Correct. There will be some yoga, asana, posture practice before the meditation.
Okay, mm-hmm. Cool. Really cool. And that's kind of what I want to talk to you about, because I'm a complete and total neophyte. If there's something less than a neophyte, that's what I am when it comes to both yoga and meditation. I know a little bit more about meditation because I've experimented a little with it, and to be honest, I've completely dropped out of that. I've been thinking about it the last couple of weeks because I find myself going to bed with just tons of thoughts in my head and not being able to quiet that down. And the first thing that happens when I wake up is I've got all these thoughts in my head. So there's like no good sleep that's happening. And I'm curious if meditation is something that I could use to hack is totally the wrong word, but to hack that basically and be better about it. Tell us a little bit about kind of where your yoga and meditation practice started and just who you are, what your background is.
Sure. So I found yoga and meditation about 13, 14. I herniated L4, L5 from a gymnastics injury from childhood and was sort of a slow burn. And I found myself in rehab with a bunch of 60-year-olds bouncing up and down in the physio ball.
Yeah.
And the seventh grade thinking, I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
And luckily, first yoga studio in Cincinnati, Ohio, which I then became owner of almost a decade later, is where I found the practice. So it was injury that led me there. And then honestly, it was the only thing that I could stay focused on through undergraduate school and graduate school that kept me going to class. So I studied all of the philosophical traditions behind what you see in commercial yoga movement today on Instagram and in yoga studios. And then I studied a branch of psychology that also supports meditative transformative experiences in graduate school.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the difference between how you see yoga today, commercial yoga, versus what you learned or traditional yoga.
Definitely. So I used to be like squeaky wheel about the whole thing.
Right.
You know, really hardcore traditionalist.
Like I used to be with trad climbing until I got smarter.
Probably similar. Yeah. Getting smarter is definitely the way to describe it. Right. How to talk to more people about the practice and get them involved instead of creating, you know, delineations around what might be perceived as right.
Right.
Commercial yoga is super interesting. We're starting to find our culture at large is realizing that we're very disembodied, right? How do I feel? Where am I? What's going on in my body-mind relationship? Aren't questions that we usually ask at young ages. You know, it's not an idea in our family unit and it's not an idea in our educational systems. So you see the West like really latching on to, wow, this is something where I actually felt what my body was doing, and I'm finding some relief in my body-mind relationship that I'm not getting from crazy mind, big talking head life.
Right.
That would be a disembodied life. So commercial yoga is definitely opening up avenues for people to get more involved in their body-mind relationship.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really important way to look at it. You know, I once heard a rapper who was, you know, he'd kind of gone commercial and was getting shit for it. And he said, you know, I make these commercial songs so that people will listen to my more important, you know, more heartfelt songs. These just pull people in. So maybe that's a great way to look at yoga as well, as the commercialization of it, you know, pulling people into the deeper practice. And not everyone's going to go that route, but some people will for sure.
Yeah, that's the hope, right? Is that it starts on a really gross level and that you start to feel more of a sense of ease in your body. And then that entices you to get more involved in the framework of your mind and the way that you're perceiving the world around you.
Yeah.
It would be step two, sort of, I'm living an embodied life.
Yeah. So even though you've moved away from the like strict traditionalism approach, are there practices you see in commercial yoga today that you're not a big fan of?
I'd have to say yes. I'm not super into hot yoga. Okay. It really pushes the boundaries of the ligaments and the tendons to a point where mobility is getting increased in those temperatures and not when you leave the studio.
Right.
It also prevents the full rhythm of your breath practice. So when your heart rate is that high and you're that exacerbated, you don't get the full exhalation. And that is like the healing technique of why you do these practices, is how to downregulate the central nervous system so that when you are in stress, you have a baseline of downregulation.
Right.
So if you keep putting the body in extreme stress and think that it can learn in extreme stress, then a little counterintuitive to say, I actually want to be calmer in stressful situations. We've got to change the circumstance to teach the body about calmness.
Yeah. Have you dug in at all to like the Wim Hof stuff where it's the extreme cold, so going the other direction?
A little bit. Some of my climbing guy friends around me, I think it's a Joe Rogan podcast. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have asked if I've listened to his ability to literally like go to a bottom baseline where there's like nothing registering because of his breath practice. And that's a little bit that I know about it.
Yeah. Super interesting. And, you know, I imagine someone could probably take that approach to something like hot yoga, but that's definitely not the norm.
Yeah. That's not like why people go. Super advanced.
Yeah.
His story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Mm-hmm. So with this commercialization of yoga, are there, and this is a totally dumb question maybe, but are there still places where you can go to learn and practice the yoga that you learned?
Definitely. You really need to seek those out.
Is there something specific to look for? Or
I generally would say get on their website and look at the founder's bio. And like really hash through the founder's bio. And if you could make contact. So, I mean, yoga is generally taught one-on-one, believe it or not. So now we're seeing these, you know, 50-person classes and all that business. But if you could make personal contact, you know, send them an email, send them a Facebook message, send them an IG message, something, and say, hey, you know, I'm intrigued about my lower back pain and I'm wondering if you could be a fit for me. Right. Okay. So I'm always an advocate of like, how do we get back to the one-on-one personal attention and say, is this teacher, do they have the anatomy knowledge to deal with what my body-mind relationship needs?
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's not just it's not just a however long yoga teacher training that a lot of people can go through and become a yoga teacher in a week or whatever.
200 hours or one weekend. Yeah. Definitely. So then that conversation would give you a little bit more information about the actual technical knowledge they have of the practice and how to apply it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you mentioned mobility a few minutes ago. And how does mobility relate to yoga? Like, I've heard so many people come to me and say, you should do yoga. It'll help your climbing because your core strength will be better.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
I heard that in my workshops this weekend too, not from me, but from students.
Yeah. And I'm just like, my core strength is better than all of you yoga teachers. Why would I go do yoga? You know? So I don't, and maybe that's a stupid response. I don't know, but I'm just curious how mobility relates to yoga and maybe how core strength does too, since these are two things I often hear kind of put into the same ring.
Yeah, totally. So the general picture of yoga that you see on Instagram or Facebook or just the commercialism, that kind of movement is moving more towards contortionism. Mm-hmm. So a really different understanding of how do I have a healthy, flexible, strong body. So I feel like a good baseline rule to think about is the stronger I am, the more stable I am, the more mobile I am, the more susceptible to injury I am.
Sure.
And that's a really nice just benchmark to say, okay, great. So if I'm doing all of these crazy binds with my shoulders, then that means when I start rock climbing, I'm more susceptible to injury.
Yeah, especially since a lot of rock climbing involves moving really dynamically, quickly, getting into these positions without, you know, moving into them slowly.
Totally.
I've seen a lot of hypermobile people get injured that way.
Definitely. I mean, on average, my asana practice has changed so much since I've been rock climbing. It's more like, how do I get stable and keep a range of mobility that increases stability?
Right.
You know, because I used to be just, you know, 13-year-old flexible all the time.
Right.
Like toe to ear, every asana kind of thing, always binding.
That doesn't even compute with me.
Toe
to ear. I don't even know what that means. I'd have to cut my foot off to get my toe to my ear.
But honestly, ego check, like why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. You know, am I doing this to get a good Instagram shot, or am I doing this to create a healthy, happy, stable body that is doing what I need it to do in the other activities in my life that are creating fun, joy, and expansion? So definitely always asking, like, am I as strong as I am mobile?
Yeah. And is this moving me toward my goals, whatever those goals are?
Totally.
I think that's really important, you know, and most of the people, all of the people listening to this are climbers. I shouldn't say that. I had some people come to the booth this weekend at the trade fair who were not climbers and just said, oh, we listen to your podcast. We love your voice and everything's really fun that you talk about. And we learn important life lessons, you know? And I was like, oh, do you guys move here for climbing? And they're like, no, we're not climbers. You know? They had a son who was a swimmer. So the Lanty and Chew episode brought them in.
Yeah. Yeah. Having the ripple effect.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. So most people who are listening are climbers for sure. And a lot of their yoga practice is going to be an avenue toward improving their climbing. Mm-hmm. They hope. So I think that's really important. Ask yourself, is this something that's improving my climbing?
Definitely. And if you're taking group classes, really beneficial to let your teacher know, right? So this is what I do in my free time, and I'm trying not to shred my rotator cuffs, because guess what? Right. I often do that in my other free time.
Right.
And figuring out what needs to be more mobile and what needs to be more stable in your body. Mm-hmm. And especially for young women that are in group classes, you know, the teacher might come and push your lower back or push in between your shoulder blades in certain asanas or yoga postures. And it's totally cool to say, hey, no, you know, I'm actually trying to get stronger in between my shoulder blades. I don't need that, you know, deep dip of mobility right there, because that's how you think it is supposed to be taught, or how it looks prettier, quote unquote.
Yeah. And this is totally, I know your answer is going to be, it depends and it's different for everyone, but where are the areas that you see most people who are involved in a regular yoga practice need to, or should maybe not worry about mobility and worry more about stability? Some of the popular, like, mobile spots that they should be stabilizing instead of mobilizing?
Shoulders and hamstrings, for sure. So there's a lot of, so the yoga that we're doing now is really only 100 years old, 150 years old, really influenced by British gymnastics. And some of the older yoga is not really designed for Western bodies. Right. So, you know, the time that I spent in India, I felt like a giant, like a huge giant, out of place. Like, and all these people live near the equator and they have totally different physiological makeup.
Sure.
And that's something to really consider about your own body's capability, and realize that, you know, some of the things that are ancient and are being appropriated in our culture might not be the best idea in terms of stability and mobility, in particular for the shoulder girdle and the hip girdle, which would just mean like pelvic area and shoulder blades, scapula, humerus bone, the humerus bone's relationship to the scapula and the chest.
Right.
So a lot of exploitation in those areas for sure.
Yeah. Are there popular postures that maybe climbers could skip over, or is there a something to focus on in those popular postures that would be better for them than the norm?
Yeah. Skip the chaturangas, which is like the transition from plank and you lower halfway down. There has to be a lot of core stability to not shred your rotator cuff. So even Ashtangis, which normally practice that type of posture, shred rotator cuffs all the time. And that's like a very normal yoga related injury. So that would be something to avoid. And then definitely any extreme internal or external rotation of the humerus bones.
Okay.
So that you're not really yanking on any of the tiny shoulder stabilizing muscles in the back or the front body.
Yeah.
Because there'll be a lot of opportunities where the teacher's like, and if you can take it one step further, reach down and grab your wrist. And then all of a sudden you see all the 45-year-old women that's the only activity they do all week.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And you're like, I can do that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I would do too. And I would tear something, I'm sure. My male ego would totally get in the way in that situation. So how do yoga and meditation, how do they mix? Where do they come into contact with each other?
So traditionally, all of the funky postures that you see are leading you towards a stable mind. So in order to sit effectively and understand your sitting is the word for practicing meditation, I'm going to sit. In order to do that, you have to understand your own attention thresholds. And so that's what all the funky postures are doing, is literally saying, what does my body-mind relationship feel like and how does it deposit into my mind?
And so they were completely intertwined.
Completely intertwined, yeah. So you can experience states of meditation in yoga postures for sure. Mm-hmm. And you can experience deep levels of how does my mind work while sitting on the cushion after you've moved your body in particular ways to create that stable state. So really the postures are medicine for a stable mind to sit.
Do you feel like you need those two practices intertwined? Should we be working on the yoga postures while learning meditation? Where do you see that joint happening?
Well, I'm starting to see a bit of a schism because our culture has a bunch of different movement practices that are interesting and that people can stick with and that people are finding contemplative expansion through. And like for me, rock climbing is one of them.
Yeah, totally.
Right. So I'm starting to see my asana practice change because climbing is taking some of its space up. And the mental component of climbing is really interesting, just as interesting as doing handstand and putting my toes on my head.
Right.
So I thought that this weekend in particular at the Climbers Festival was a cool opportunity to not teach any yoga postures because it's really easy to get involved in the gross aspects. And most of our culture will gravitate towards learning downward dog before they would sitting on the cushion in silence for 10 minutes a day.
Right. Yeah, totally.
So I thought it was a cool opportunity to teach no yoga postures and just a sitting practice.
Oh, that's really interesting. I've often referred to climbing as my version of moving meditation.
Totally.
I really feel like I go into the same place that I hear about with people who have a really deep meditation practice while I'm climbing. And I think recently the reason I've been feeling a little restless is because I haven't been climbing outside as much and I haven't been connecting with that place. And I don't have a good non-climbing meditative practice at all. So I think that's something that might be helpful for me to incorporate somehow.
Totally, yeah.
Is there a way that you feel like getting started for people in a non-moving, a non-climbing meditation? It could be moving as well, but a non-climbing meditation, is there a good way to get started with that?
Definitely.
That'll help it stick?
Yeah. So someone came up to me on Sunday and asked me that. So like, what should I do? How do I know when in the day to do this? Like, how do I get started when Monday rolls around?
Yeah.
And my advice to her was, for the next 7 days, keep a mood journal. And it doesn't have to be an aggressive, you know, long paragraph each time you check in. But basically to look at the flow of your day and say, when is my attention span the most willing to do this? So if you have kids or you are a runner or a climber or you work, right, you check in the morning and you say, how do I feel? You check in mid-morning, afternoon, mid-afternoon, and evening. And you start asking yourself, wait, when is my attention threshold primed for this?
And what would that look like? What would primed
attention means,
threshold look like?
Not when I'm super tired, not when I had to do all of the tasks for my kids, you know, maybe not after I had to go to the grocery store and use my analytical mind. Maybe I tapped my attention threshold sending 150 emails today.
Which I did.
Yeah. So maybe before that, right?
Yeah.
And really starting to figure out where I could plug in a 5 to 10 minute sit a day. And there are a bunch of different apps. You can go to my website. I have like 10 to 15 free guided meditations where you can seek out guidance to keep your attention engaged in the present moment for 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes.
Cool. And are these recorded things that people would just put headphones on and
totally
sit down? And I'll definitely link to those in the show notes.
That's a great starting spot. And then, you know, pretty quickly after, it's also totally cool to sit in silence. So just set your iPhone timer and do nothing. And then you're going to notice, oh my goodness, my mind is doing 120,000 things.
Yeah.
And I want to learn about those 120,000 things. Like, where is it going? What is it doing? And what is it imagining? And what is it getting kicks from? And what is it getting bored of? And da 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 da.
Yeah.
So being able to do that in silence is a guided meditation's wonderful place to start. And then eventually, how do I figure out the animal that I am in this tiny petri dish of 5 minutes, 10 minutes?
Hmm.
And it's a real self-resiliency practice to do that on your own, like a self-motivating way to say, I'm intrigued by this and I'm going to learn more about myself.
Yeah, totally. All right. So let's use me as an example here.
Sure.
Totally selfishly. this morning, for instance, I have my phone. I do use my phone, which I know is a bad practice, as my alarm in the mornings. But I have it set so that I don't receive any notifications at all of any kind from like 10 p.m. to 8 a.m.
Silence.
And then my alarm went off this morning. And when I hit the stop button on the alarm, my screen popped up that showed a lot of the things that had come in. And the first thing on there was an email from one of the women that I work with, Colette McInerney. And just the first line in it made me start thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And then my brain is going crazy. Like, all I saw were the first few words. And then for the next 5 minutes while I'm laying there, I'm thinking, I could have her do this and she could do this. And I wonder if we could fit this in and we should take this out. And I'm like, my brain's going crazy about her training plan now. In that situation, should I get up and try to quiet that down? What's because the morning is definitely the best time for me. Annalise is still asleep.
Yeah.
I get up, I make coffee, and it's pretty quiet. But my brain is not.
Totally.
My brain starts going a little crazy.
So there's a misperception about meditation that we will be able to quiet the mind.
Right.
Right. And that's like Olympic meditator status. Like people that have, you know, put as much time as Michael Phelps has into swimming,
mm-hmm.
have put that much time into seated meditation. So the idea that we're going to be able to quiet the mind is a misperception to begin with. So let's say you get up, you see the alert, everything's going on. You know Annalisa doesn't get up for another 90 minutes. Totally cool. Sit down, set a timer for yourself. I'm going to do
90 minutes is very generous. It's more like 2.5 hours. Just saying.
You can set a personal timer for yourself. I'm going to do everything at the top of the list for 45 minutes. I'm going to drink the coffee. I'm going to answer the pressing emails, right? Because we want to set the mind up, like all the causes and conditions for success.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do end up sitting down and mind is racing, 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 it might be beneficial to actually, and not if it's saying, go eat a bowl of cereal, right? That's
right.
That will happen as well
right.
when you sit. But if there's any sort of like life pressing issues, then it's totally cool. I'm going to spend 60 minutes doing that right when I wake up. So that when I go to sit, I have a little bit more of a not, you know, reaching into my life so much. Yeah, totally fine. It's like when I used to have a 9-to-5, I knew my mind was most productive from 6 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. So that was the time that I used to deal with the back end of the website,
right?
And then like noon rolled around and I was like, sweet, I have a little bit of a break. Now is the time I'm going to meditate and practice.
I really like that. It sets me up for success on a bunch of levels because I am most productive first thing in the morning. Even though it's the quietest, maybe because it's the quietest time, that's when I'm most productive. And I have a really bad habit that's been forming of, I just forget to eat any food at all. I just start working and there's no food happens until noon, 12:30.
Yeah.
You know, I had to shove yogurt in my face before you guys got here because I realized I hadn't eaten.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like to me, and I hit kind of a lull after about an hour or so of answering, you know, furiously getting work done. I definitely hit a bit of a wall that I have to change venues. Mm-hmm. Normally I'll start at the kitchen table. When that lull hits, I move up here into the office and can sort of renew my vigor and get more things done. But what might be better is to, when that lull hits, sit for a few minutes and then after that, make breakfast and then get back to work.
Yeah, super valuable. So you want to ride the current of who you are. Mm-hmm. And instead of implementing something that you would get rid of in 7 to 8 days.
Yeah.
So there's studies out there that the mind can focus for, you know, 45 minutes at a time, and it's totally fine to take that 45 minutes and then the 10 minutes of the next hour as a meditative sit when you know that your mind isn't going to be the most quote unquote work productive. Right. So, and I also often tell my students, if they find they're like in the transition times of your day, when you're getting on social media or you reach for your cell phone to text a friend, like when you naturally feel your attention break, that mm-hmm. would be an awesome time to put in the 5 to 10 minute sit
cool.
instead of reaching for like the numbing activity that you might already be reaching for during that time.
Right.
So that would be a messenger of like, okay, cool. This would be the time.
Right. Yeah, that's really, really great advice. You mentioned when you were kind of talking about how this morning might play out, you said drink the coffee, do the things. How do you see, because I don't even acknowledge that decaffeinated coffee exists. So how does caffeine affect meditation?
Yeah, well, it's certainly going to rev your central nervous system. Right.
Yeah,
and put different chemicals in your body than if you were drinking water with lemon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not super, super strict anymore. Right. I've had teachers in the past that would tell me, you showed up drugged this morning for practice because I stopped at the only coffee shop open, Dunkin' Donuts, at 4:45 a.m. on the way into the yoga studio.
Yeah. That would be
so
really
bad. I probably can't honestly give you a good.
Because there's donuts there too.
Can't give you an honest answer on that because I'm definitely a caffeine drinker.
Yeah.
But it will rev your central nervous system to the point where if you close your eyes and you watch your pupil underneath your eyelid, that's the activity of your central nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm definitely an advocate of empirical evidence in your own body, and that's definitely what I trust.
Sure.
So drink a coffee, close the eyes, watch the pupils, mm-hmm. and then ask, okay, let me try this at 2 p.m. when I haven't had a coffee. Close the eyes, watch the pupils. Which state do I want to sit in?
Okay.
Yeah.
And describe what you mean by watch the pupils.
Kind of like the white ball over the sentence of those old school cartoons.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you'll notice your pupil like doing the exact same thing that the mind's doing, like or
okay. Yeah.
Is that a good description?
That was actually a perfect description. Your cartoon noises are great. I'm gonna sample those and use them somewhere else. Yeah, and it might, you know, it might be fun to experiment with just, you know, back to that situation that we discussed. It might be fun to experiment with using that first 30, 45 minutes, whatever, to just drink water and do work, then sit, then have coffee with breakfast, you
totally.
Know, rather than going straight for the coffee, bleary-eyed, first thing in the morning. It could be a really interesting experiment, trying it both ways and see what works for me.
Definitely. And I think just the fact that you're already interested in setting up an experiment is saying like, it's more probable that I could get information back that's going to convince the mind that this is time well spent,
mm-hmm.
which is really, really important.
Yeah, totally. How do you see these things? And maybe we've already answered this a little bit, but talk to me about how you see these things, yoga, meditation, helping climbers.
For sure.
Both in like just general wellness and in their climbing practice.
Yeah. General wellness, I can start there for sure, is there's so much of my self-image and emotions and feelings and chemicals involved in the process of rock climbing even before it starts.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah, like when absolutely. You wake up and this is what you're going to do today. And, you know, my husband, my climbing partner and I are going to the Craig and this is what we're going to get on. And just the whole slide of emotions and like body engagement even before it happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the practice of meditation on a really simple level has helped the both of us to communicate with each other more effectively about what we're feeling, what our goals are, what our like micro goals are. I tend to be a little more focused on like micro goals, like, oh, I'm going to work on my foot placement today.
Yeah.
Right. Perfect. Things like that. It's helped me understand like, wow, my body is already so engaged in the route that I'm not even on yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what are all the ways that I can like pool all my resources to be calmer and more aware and less reactive, like the whole trajectory that it takes to actually like start lacing up my shoes and get there.
Right.
And then, you know, we're relatively new to climbing. So just the nerves in general and like the personal pressure and like really being able to sort through that in a meditative way, because we're in touch with our body-mind relationships to begin with, which, mm-hmm. you know, it's difficult when you're already engaged in the stress to get a handle on where you are and how you're behaving.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, a baseline of how to observe that stress is really, really valuable.
Yeah, I think that's a really big part of what any reason that I would suggest to people. Just from my very, very baseline, low level knowledge of mm-hmm. yoga and meditation. That would be my biggest reason for asking someone to experiment with it.
Totally.
As opposed to core strength or to get flexible. You know, I personally feel like, and tell me if you think I'm crazy, but I think that if core strength is what you're after, there are much better ways to get a stronger core. And if flexibility is what you're after, there are better ways to just get flexible. But if it's this whole, as you're calling it, a mind-body relationship that you're interested in, learning mm-hmm. to access your core, access your mobility, and to be able to just make that connection between your thoughts, your emotions, and what your body's doing. I think yoga and meditation are far better at that
mm-hmm.
than just a core workout or stretching.
Yes, I'd have to agree with you. I do think that they have an incredible way to show the climber, or, you know, this came up on Sunday. Someone said, I've been climbing for a while, but I came to this because I'm starting a new job next week and I'm nervous about it. Right. And,
yeah.
you know, something climbing is very contemplative in nature, and contemplative meaning I'm learning things about myself through this activity.
Yeah.
And then yoga and meditation have a very pointed way of really making big synaptic connections across many different personality aspects in your life, that it might be hard to take some of the lessons that you learned at the Craig and take them into your job interview, even though you already are having a lot of experiences of like confidence and empowerment and a posture of success and da 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 da.
Right.
Yoga could definitely bridge that gap of, yeah, this is things I'm learning in climbing that is very applicable to the way that I live my life.
That's a really good way to look at it. I want to know a little bit about your personal journey at this point, from starting with yoga, finding climbing, how that's changed yoga for you, and sort of what that whole practice altogether looks like now. Because I'm sure you're not the only one in this situation where you mm-hmm. were practicing yoga long before you found climbing.
Definitely. I would say climbing has changed my yoga life dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
to the point where it was like, what? People are living in vans and traveling all over the place? What am I doing having a job in one city? Right? To the point where I closed my yoga studios and was like, I'm going to follow rock climbing for a while.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that's kind of like the funny anecdote. But I do find that climbing provides, so I was a elite gymnast as a child, mm-hmm. which is kind of cheating. You know, when it's like, oh, how can you do that handstand?
Right.
You know, like, well, okay, I just won't tell you that I've been doing that since age, you know, four.
Right.
But I think climbing added a whole nother level of extreme stress and having to confront the person that I am under large amounts of fear. Hmm. That sometimes the yoga mat, you know, the little magic carpet on the wood floor in the clean, nice studio doesn't always give you that sort of a petri dish of like real serious emotions coursing through the body. Mm-hmm. And I feel like climbing has showed me a lot about like the power of being strong. And I do think the yoga community at large tends more towards flexibility. So it's given me a totally different understanding of my body and its capabilities, which is exciting, you know, in my early 30s and feeling different in my early 30s than I did in my early 20s. And like the limitless capacity of still getting stronger and more capable as I age, because I think the climbing community has a lot of really good role models that show that.
Yeah.
So that's pretty exciting. And I think it's made me a lot more interested. I mean, I've always been really interested in the mental capacities of the human being. Mm-hmm. And I think that climbing has opened that Pandora's box inside my yoga study even more. Like, what are the mental capabilities that affect the way that the body performs of the human being? So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that climbing has sort of taken up a big chunk of your yoga practice. Mm-hmm. What's that look like now, time-wise?
Totally.
Like, what did yoga and meditation look like for you prior to climbing? How much time were you spending on it, and what's that look like now?
Yeah. So prior to climbing, I mean, sometimes I'd pick up running or road biking or swimming occasionally, mm-hmm. but prior to climbing, it was 2.5 to 3 hours of asana a day and teaching full time.
Right.
So, you know, that's really all my body did was yoga postures for about a decade. And then once I started climbing, so about 3 years into climbing now, you know, I remember when I first went into the gym, everyone was like, you're going to be so strong because of yoga.
Right.
And I'm like, this VB is kicking my ass.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So really having to get like real with what my body's weaknesses are in relationship to climbing and let some of my like yoga teacher ego go to the point that, you know, I don't need to be doing all these crazy impressive postures anymore because I actually want to get stronger in certain ways.
Right.
So just duration of time. I mean, I probably do what looks like only really restorative mobility exercises 3 to 4 times a week now. On top of climbing, you know, and then sometimes I have fun playing around on like my handstand canes and which are like the handstand platforms, you know,
right.
But that's just like more pure acrobatic joy.
Which are always really cool to look at on Instagram, so.
Yeah, they're fun. Yeah, and then things like aerial silks and stuff, but that's more just like playing around for joy. Like I'm not really training for anything in specific.
Right.
That's just exploring what my body likes to do and what it's
actually
good at. And
I think that's a hugely important part of becoming a better athlete or, you know, keeping your athletic skills up.
Totally.
You know, just like being really good at yoga didn't necessarily translate over into being really good at climbing right off the bat. I mean, that would be the same as me saying, oh, I'm a good climber, so I'll just go teach yoga. You know, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. It's funny how yoga's gotten that.
Yeah.
Like tag, I guess you could say like, oh yeah, you're so strong. It'll be great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some people are, you know, some people are naturally like that, but mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't cross all boundaries in the regard that it's like seen as nowadays.
Yeah, totally, totally. And another thing I kind of want to talk about, if you're open to it, totally mm-hmm. up to you, is that you took a bad fall early on, really early on in your climbing.
Yeah.
And have just recently been on this upward trajectory that's really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
how much did yoga and meditation play into being able to successfully come back from that? And I'm asking that partly because one of my very first episodes of the podcast, I don't remember what number it was, two or three maybe, was with my friend Ranvai Umot, and she had taken a big fall and is also involved in yoga and meditation and seems to have made this miraculous comeback both physically and mentally. And I'm curious how much that played into your coming back and becoming a much better climber than you were at the time. And just what does that look like in practice?
Totally. Yeah. So, decked from about 40 feet, like my second weekend leading.
Right.
Yeah. which is nuts.
Which is pretty much game over for most people.
Right.
You know, just most people would respond to that with, okay, I'm not climbing ever again.
Yeah. So after I fell, I feel like the meditation practice I had had prior to falling really developed a mental resiliency that might not have previously been there and would have said, like, no way in hell are you ever going to do that again. But part of me had a realization, you know, when it was in the hospital and when my bladder wasn't working, that you might not really get to do anything again. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Right. We don't really know, you know, you might have a pee bag for the next year, like right. A bag where it catches my urine and I have to carry it around, you know. And my husband and I had just started dating at the time. And I basically said, if you don't think I look sexy in Amish skirts and a bedazzled pee bag as a purse, like, you better get out of here.
But can you actually get bedazzled pee bags?
Oh, I would have. Yeah. And I think that mental resiliency of, you know, it's okay what happened. It's totally okay, right? I'm still here and I still have the capability to live a happy, full life that looks totally different. And that's something that I'm really willing to accept. And then about 3-4 weeks after, like, everything started functioning fine in terms of organs and bladder. And, you know, my husband's still going to the climbing gym, like still going to the bouldering gym.
Right.
And like, I wasn't really ready to get on ropes yet. And I wasn't even fully healed in my S2, which I had fractured, and that was it. Like I walked away with only a tiny fracture in my sacrum, which is just so lucky. So I really heard the universe loud and clear on that one. Like, okay, well, maybe I'll go to the bouldering gym and just do the traverse wall. And I spent a lot of time on like 1 foot off the ground, like just on the traverse wall.
Yeah. At climb time.
Yep, at climb time in Cincinnati.
Yeah. I spent a lot of my early days just traversing back and forth at climb time by myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was cool because the climbing community is really supportive, you know, so no one pushed me. Like in the gym, I think people, they knew that I had fallen, but no one really asked me about it, which I was really grateful for because it didn't bring up the memory like in the environment. And everyone just sort of let me traverse on the traverse wall until I was ready to get on something else. Right. And, you know, meditation wise, I feel like it helped a lot learning how to trust other partners. So I started climbing with other people and letting other people catch me. And, you know, I wouldn't say I'm 100%, like I hear people say, trust the gear. So like my husband's getting a little interested in trad and I'm like, no way yet.
Right.
No way yet. Like I haven't even fully trusted the sport gear yet.
Yep.
Which is just, you know, that's just in my central nervous system and something that I still have to think about and deal with on a regular basis. And when I feel like the fear arise, it is pretty difficult to say, you know, you can trust that this is going to catch you. You can trust that the person below you is going to catch you. It's definitely still in there, but it doesn't stop me from like wanting to be in that fearful state so that I can learn about myself.
Yeah, you keep saying learn about yourself, and I think that's a really important part of all this, that you can practice meditation, you can practice yoga, and I'm using the word practice there very lightly, and still never learn about yourself.
100%. That's really important.
And maybe that's part of the commercialization or part of the negative side of the commercialization of it is there are more and more people not learning about themselves through these things. So I think it's really important to keep that in mind, that learning about yourself is really the ultimate goal here, whether it's yoga, meditation, climbing, any of it or all of it. It's really all about learning about yourself.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, why else would you do it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's why.
To look cool on Instagram.
We can learn about yourself and still look cool on Instagram. It's possible to do both.
I'm trying to learn how, actually. And you mentioned that you and Dan's climbing relationship is different through yoga, that you guys communicate better, partly because of the yoga. And Dan, you've been sitting in here as well, and we turned the mic on just in case. So I'm going to pull you in a little bit. Did you just sort of come across yoga because of Ashley?
No, I had some prior experience to yoga through my previous endeavor, which was baseball.
Yeah, you were a high level baseball player before, so
right.
Come into athletics
and
in that way.
Kind of, I was exposed to it in that way. It was through other guys that I was playing with, but the mentality wasn't so much of what I've learned since from Ashley and you know what we've been talking about for the last half hour or so. It was more kind of goal oriented. You know, looking at the pictures of those climax poses and saying like, oh, you know, that's ultimately what you want to do. But,
right. You
know, as a 25-year-old who had been pitching for 20 years at that point with the shoulder surgery, 99.9% of that stuff is never going to happen.
Right.
So for me, I was kind of spinning my wheels with yoga for probably about 3 or 4 years. And then I met Ashley and was able to kind of see, you know, it's not like a me versus them to who can get this pose or something like that. It's
right.
This internal thing that ultimately isn't even really about the poses. So through her, I've had a lot of realizations that obviously would have been nice to have those from Jump Street, but it was kind of nice to have this full perspective of yoga, seeing it from kind of the naive perspective. Still naive now, but at least have more of a glimpse and idea of, you know, why I'm actually doing this versus, you know, the goal-oriented approach.
Yeah, and do you guys practice together? Or are you more in a teacher role when Dan is practicing? How does that look?
Totally. So I do not want to be my husband's teacher.
Yeah, well, that's a really good plan.
Totally.
Because Annalise is my absolute worst student.
Yeah.
She's a really good climber, but not when we're together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, like also all jokes aside, it's like, like I only want him to do it if he wants to do it.
Sure.
And he's 100% engaged in it. Because then it's always a push-pull, and that takes more energy from me. And
right,
that's
right.
Not a trade I'm willing to make.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, early on in our relationship, I was like, let's go and sit in front of other teachers together, right? So sometimes we would go take classes together or work on different, like, mental ideas or prompts together. And then now it's basically like if I roll out my yoga mat, I mean, about 10 minutes later, he rolls out his.
Right.
Yeah.
Or vice versa.
which is great there. Because, you know, that's time that I need for myself. And then it is much more effective if he's learning his like own relationship to himself without, you know, my dialogue in there.
Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think a lot of couples tend to do things together. You know, especially if there's a climber couple who's just discovering yoga, it's going to tend to be a couple's thing often. So yeah, I was just curious how the practice looks for the two of you together.
Yeah.
A lot of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think through those discussions, which were kind of evoked through the yoga and meditation aspect of our lives, I think it had kind of saved our climbing relationship. because there was a lot of things that I wasn't being honest with and was trying to suppress, you know, after the incident with her decking, that had been suppressed for 2 or 3 years after the fact that were coming up on a daily basis with us climbing. And I'm sure there was stuff that she had as well, but the dialogue facilitated kind of airing all that stuff. And since we've had those conversations, I think our climbing relationship and just everyday life relationship has really, really improved from it.
Yeah, well, that's really important. You know, you two both are taking climbing pretty seriously. I've been working with both of you for, it's almost 2 years now. It'll be 2 years this winter, yeah. So you both take it pretty seriously, and a lot of emotions and feelings get tied up into something that you're taking that seriously. So I think it's really important to have that outlet where you can discuss it. And if yoga facilitates that, then all that much better. Totally. You know, it's because at the crag is not the place to have that discussion.
Exactly. No. Yeah.
And I'm sure you guys have discovered that as the same as I have, you know, with Annalisa. So it's better to have that in another venue, a neutral place.
Totally.
You know, especially for us, because I'm definitely I'm a climbing coach and trainer, and I'm the better climber. So she'll default to me if I let that happen.
Right.
And I don't think that's a productive way to have any sort of discussion, you know, because at that point we're not on a level playing field. So I think that's a really important thing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's a like wise realization. I think that took us a little bit of struggling to get to after the decking of, you know, how do we deal with this? Because we both want to keep climbing and we both want to stay really committed to it. And we see it's, you know, positively affecting our lives. And we want to make sure that it's still positively affecting our lives.
Cool. And I really love the idea of the meditation for climbers workshop and discussion that you did here. I didn't get to attend, but I'm very interested in the idea. So can you tell me just a little bit about what that looks like? Because I'm hoping that's going to happen more in the future.
Yeah, I think it'd be pretty cool to happen more in the future. I was excited with how they went. So I read a little bit of Arno's work, and I read a little bit of Vertical Mind. You know, as having studied transpersonal psych and Buddhist philosophy, which is where my heart really sits, you know, I appreciated a lot of their work, but there is a lot of front end work of trying to figure out what are your self-limiting beliefs. Right. So we know we hold them, and we know that fear and in Vertical Mind, he uses the word schema, which there's a translation word in Sanskrit, which is called samskara, which means a limiting belief that I hold that's putting a glass ceiling over my future progression trajectory or self-understanding.
Right.
And there's a lot of work to be done there, if that makes sense, figuring out what is the self-limiting belief. And yoga has an uncanny way to like get into the kernel of what is causing misperception in our lives. Or in our climbing, right? I really don't separate the two, right?
Right.
So it's like everything I do in my waking life is a reflection of the way I see the world.
Right.
So,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, can't separate those things. So in the workshops themselves, we explored a lot of feelings of what opposites feel like in the body, cultivating like a sense of anxiety and cultivating a sense of empowerment and really figuring out where these emotions land in the body. So when you go and get into a high stress situation, it's very, very likely that how you behaved previously is how you're going to behave. And the more often that you do that, like the present moment choices you make write the future for you. So they're actually pulling your ability to choose, like ripping it from your fingertips, the more that you make the same decision in a stressful situation. So there's some front work to do there of why am I making that decision? Like what part of my self-image thinks that that's valid and where did it work in the past?
Right.
So in the workshops, I wanted us to explore a sense of opposites in the body and where those emotions fall so that you can do that in a petri dish environment, not when you're hanging on a crimp trying to clip the fourth pole.
Right.
Because chances are you're going to behave how you behaved the last time you were hanging off the crimp.
Absolutely. Yeah, both emotionally and physically. I mean, this is why we recommend doing a lot of the drills that we've developed while warming up, because I want you to do it when there are no other stressors involved, when
totally.
You're not focused on sending, when you're not pumped, when you're not physically fatigued or powered down. I want you to be able to focus on how you're pressing with your feet or how you're driving through your arms, while that's the only thing you have to think about,
mm-hmm.
you know? So it's a really, sounds like a really similar thing.
Totally. And I feel like, honestly, I've gotten the most out of your program, the warm-ups.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because sometimes when I'm climbing, I'm like, what? I did that? Because I've been practicing it somewhere else.
Right,
like,
totally.
What? I just did it? I didn't even think about it.
Yeah. And being open to embracing that, I think, is where you're getting the benefit, you know? And you've learned that through yoga and meditation.
Mm-hmm, totally.
So I think that's one
similar
of the,
approaches.
Another one of the really important parts of all this.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. We might have to pull you into some of these training camp ideas we've been having, because I think it would be a really valuable piece to give to people
totally.
You know, who are trying to coach themselves and become better climbers.
Yeah, any mental perspective one can gain can be valuable.
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I appreciate you sitting down, and I think this has been really valuable for me. I think a lot of people are in my shoes where they don't really know where to start or where to begin and or what it all means even.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is a really great primer just on how to think about it, how to approach it, how to get started. I think sometime in the future, we're going to have to do this again and dig in a little further. So
sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks.
Yeah.
This has been a really great conversation for me to listen back to, because my life is so hectic and busy, particularly these last couple of months. I didn't at all anticipate how much crazier it was going to be working on the road. And I'm really just learning how to deal with that. And those times of quiet reflection and meditation are what's getting me through at this point, and making it so that I can enjoy climbing when I'm climbing and focus on my work when I'm working. Yoga is something I've always been interested in to some degree, but I've never been okay, like I mentioned in this conversation, with the, oh, you should do yoga, it'll make you more flexible, or it'll make your core stronger. If I wanted to be flexible or have my core stronger, there are better ways to do that. So I think Sue's explanation and her approach to this holistic sort of 360 degree organic approach to yoga and meditation within your daily life and how it applies to your daily life is so important. And I'm going to be listening back to this one more than once. If you're interested in contacting Sue, you can do that through livelightlyyoga.com. I'll also have links to that right there in the show notes in your pocket supercomputers. She's got workshops on her schedule. She's got retreats on her schedule. And there are a bunch of offerings for one-on-one practice as well. So definitely reach out to her if this is something that you're interested in. Like I said before, if you happen to be in the Sydney, Melbourne, or Perth areas, I will be coming your way soon. Check out the website, powercompanyclimbing.com/OzTour, and book one of those few remaining spots in our workshops. Don't forget to get your t-shirt while you're there, and I will see you soon. For the rest of you, you know where to find us, powercompanyclimbing.com. You can find us on the Instagrams and the Facebooks, at Power Company Climbing, and you can search for us all day on Twitter. You won't find us because we don't tweet. We scream like eagles. This time to build power. This time to build power. This time to build power. This time to build power.
This time to build.